Flex Your Head!
Welcome back to Flex Your Head, another special episode of Scream Therapy. On Flex Your Head, we take a breather from punk rock and mental health and explore classic punk albums, which I guess is good for mental health. All right, well, welcome back to Flex Your Head. It's been a little while, Donald, since last time we talked. Good to have you back.
Great to be back.
I think the last one was White Lung?
No, we did McCluskey.
Oh, McCluskey, of course.
Such a popular band that you've already forgot about them.
Yeah. Today we're going to be listening to an album that you and I both find to be quite interesting. Do you want to let us know what it is?
Yeah, we're doing the Blood Brothers Burn Piano Island Burn from 2003.
Burn Piano Island Burn, it was the third full-length that the Blood Brothers did, and they did it on a record label called Artist Direct, which is a branch of BMG. We'll get into that in a bit. It's very ominous sounding. That was in 2003, like you said, and then it was reissued in 2009 on Epitaph Records. The Blood Brothers are from the Seattle area. A lot of them lived in Redmond, Washington, which is a really cool place where I once went to a show at the Firehouse, which is a famous all-ages venue that these guys all played at. The members of the band, we have two vocalists, which is one of their like real trademarks, Jordan Bliley and also Johnny Whitney. And Johnny Whitney played some instruments on the album as well, including Lawnmower, which we should try to figure out what that means. Morgan Henderson on bass and piano, Mark Gajahar on drums, and the one-of-a-kind guitar player, Cody Vadalato. The first thing I want to ask you, Donald, is what's up with these guys? Like, what are they trying to do?
I remember them being the pick of every cool kid and scenester at the time. This was a hugely popular band in this area, and I was living in Victoria at the time this album came out, and like every cool kid was all over the Blood Brothers, wanted to go down to Seattle and watch their show. And I actually wanted to ask you, because you know, when this band comes up, all the reviews talk about you kind of the unique vocal style. It kind of being a little bit like one of a kind, something the reviewer has never heard before. And I mean, you were a guy who was like deep within, for lack of a better term, loud music scene at the time, you know, working as a reviewer. Like, how unique were they for their time? Before I was jumping on this call, I decided to turn on the Locust Plague Soundscapes,
yeah,
which came out the same year. And they shared a label, maybe not at the same time, but, you know, both released stuff on 31G. And just listening to that, you know, opening out of Plague Soundscapes, like, this does sound, you know, more grindy than Blood Brothers, but the vocal style is kind of similar.
For although sure.
The Locusts were a way more polarizing band.
Those were the two bands that really changed the direction, or shifted a different direction from being, you know, really serious, emotional hardcore with political lyrics and overtly political lyrics, and going into this more arty, like kind of fashionista sort of.
White belts.
Exactly. White belts and tight pants.
And playing lawnmowers and sheet metal. I remember being at a Locust show where they were completely alienating everybody.
At the time, I was like, I don't want it to be so arty and so weirdo. But now, in retrospect, they were very trailblazing in that style, and the Locust as well, who I always kind of loved, but just were so unapproachable, which I think these guys are too. But some of the biggest bands in other scenes were directly inspired by these guys. And to answer your question, they definitely changed the face of hardcore at that time. But there was also bands before them that they were inspired by. There's a band called McKilty of Fairies. Who were like a spazzy hardcore band with really high-pitched vocals. Behead the Prophet, No Lord Shall Live. Real mouthful there. Another band that was connected to that scene. They found their inspiration as well. And it wasn't like they were doing something like it was 100% brand new. But, I mean, they definitely took it and ran with it. Even the abrasiveness of this record in general. We'll get into what happened with Ross Robinson. He's a big, called the godfather of nu metal. You know, he produced like Slipknot and Korn and Limp Bizkit, and he kind of took these guys under his wing and created this album, Burn Piano Island Burn, which they never did get this sound again. And it's just a really unique album.
For sure.
The one thing that really strikes me, and I think we talked about this before, but just having the two singers and having them just like nattering each other, like there's no breaks. It's just like, da, 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 da. Like it's just, and it's a form of chaos that people might overhear and say, what is going on? But for someone like me with that kind of like, I want the abrasiveness. It's cool the way they do it. Having one guy that's really high pitched and then the other guy's a bit more screamy really works for me, really hits the spot.
Everybody in the band just sounds like they're careening off each other, like, I don't know, particles in a particle accelerator or something. I don't know. Like when you're listening to the album, it almost feels like being inside a mosh pit. I mean, the vocals do it for me. I mean, they're definitely what drew me to the band. That and probably the weird abstract lyrics and
yeah,
the overall crazy energy, but definitely, you know, the lyrics and vocals style got me.
I would love to hear the isolated tracks of Cody Vodolato's guitar because he's very jangly in a really good way, but also the stuff he's doing in behind the scenes with the noise and the, you know, he's not driving a lot of the songs. It's really very much the bass and drums and, of course, those chaotic vocals, which just won't stop.
Yeah, the drummer really keeps it together, Mark. Yeah.
Yeah, but the guitar work that he's doing is just amazing. And like I said, if I could have an isolated track so I could really hear it, because you really got to like find
it. It's buried in there a little, yeah.
Weird time signatures over the screaming. And I guess what I was thinking a lot during listening to this the last couple weeks is like, how do you write a song like this? Like, are you basically just piling stuff on? Are you doing it on purpose? Like, are you like creating the bits and sort of meshing it together? Hey, I'll do this thing and I'll do this thing. Are you just like piling shit? You know, it just feels like it's such a mess.
Yeah.
You know?
Is it just like a jam session?
Yeah, I guess it's been 25 years and I don't really still understand it. You know, it's like a very unapproachable album in a lot of ways, but it's also really catchy and interesting. So you can kind of get sucked into it.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know if there is necessarily something to understand. I mean, and they've kind of admitted the lyrics in particular are so abstract that they're, you know, totally unapproachable. Mm-hmm. And I think it was Bliley who said, you know, at the time, you're like, they're pretty young, right? But like 19, 20, he wasn't really able to express himself and his feelings confidently. So he was just like layering anything that might be personal under like 52 layers of metaphor.
There was messages here. They were just like wrapped up in these really weirdo, semi-poetic. Yeah, we'll get into the lyrics for sure. As far as the songs on the album, I mean, for me, it's always been like the punkier songs were the best for me, just because that's how I would lean. Fucking's Greatest Hits and Ambulance versus Ambulance are the two that I would always go back to. But I mean, now that I've spent some time getting more into the sort of vaudevillian songs, you know, the ones kind of like later in the album, The Salesman, Denver Max, and Cecilia and the Silhouette Saloon, these kind of songs that have a bit more of a narrative to them.
Yeah, that kind of middle of the album is why I enjoy the most, sort of from Ambulance Versus Ambulance to Denver Max. I mean, the kind of like stabbing guitar at the start of Ambulance yeah. Versus Ambulance is just like a great hook, grabs you right away.
Talk about the whole trend of goofy song names. I mean, got to the point with some of the kind of emo hardcore or spazzy bands where the song names were just like way out there, like full sentences long and stuff. But they had some pretty funny ones like Six Nightmares at the Pinball Masquerade and God Bless You, Bloodthirsty Zeppelins. Like,
they were definitely drawing on some like grindcore influences there.
I know where the canaries and the crows go. Whatever, guys. But what a cool band, really. I mean, they've created this whole, not a persona, but more like a vibe. The lyrics, we could read all the songs out. It would all be great. But the band did say that they aimed to use like imagery to create the overall sense of psychological terror / dread that then informs the politics. They also said that they were reading a lot of nonfiction and just trying to understand the world. And they end up like writing some songs from, and this is going to blow your mind, but from the perspective of independent of multinational corporations owned and controlled by the media, they're reading a lot of Zinn and Noam Chomsky. There you go.
I guess it's like Chomsky was popular at the time because he was influencing Rage Against the Machine. So a lot of people were kind of discovering him that way.
In some strange way, it has kind of the same wordplay, right? Chomsky gives all about like picking every single, the best possible word that he could pick for each word that he said. And something about these lyrics kind of has that too. Like, it feels like they spent a lot of time writing them and rewriting them. And it sounds like nonsense in some ways, but it's also very like put together, you know, it's got really cool structure and framing.
Yeah. It's very intentional. There's not, I mean, some of it might be a little bit tossed off, but it doesn't feel that way. It feels like they're very, being as you say, like very intentional about the words they're picking, how they're putting them together, almost like painting with language at points rather than trying to clearly communicate some like message or idea. It's just like, how can we make the English language sound interesting? What words can we throw together?
The first song is only 40 seconds long. It's kind of like an intro to the whole album. It's called Guitar Me, like Guitar Army. And the lyrics are, and it just starts out with this: do you remember us? We wrapped our Corvette in cellophane and set it aflame. Raise a glass to the Guitar Army. And then moving right into Fucking His Greatest Hits, it's like just this rallying cry of like, it feels like almost like a protest song, but way out there. Ring out the gong again. Carve out this hymn in skin. When they've pissed between every sheet of your father's bed, those tears of barcodes waiting to be scanned / scammed. And when they hurled every gutted couch cushion from the living room into your father's swimming pool, you're bobbing chlorine apples in the broth bucket of Envy's gruel. Okay.
There's the anti-capitalist streak, I guess.
And I just want to continue because this is just like some real choice stuff. So on the title track, Burn Piano Island Burn, it says, bulimic rainbows vomit what? Burn Piano Island Burn. Coconut pupils never shut? Burn Piano Island Burn. Jigsaw babies and their bamboo stilts? Burn Piano Island Burn. Charred toucans waving their black sky quilt? Burn Piano Island Burn. There's something in there, but I don't know how to decipher it.
Yeah, I don't either. And a lot of the interviewers talk about, you know, Piano Island being a theme on other records as well. But I don't know if they ever fully answer what Piano Island was in their mind.
There is one interview I read where the interviewer asks that, and then Johnny Whitney, who I'm assuming wrote some of these lyrics, talked about how it was something that they've always kind of talked about as a concept, but never really knew exactly what it meant. It's like they say, oh yeah, Piano Island, one of those kinds of things.
Right. Just like an in-joke, yeah.
Any lyrics that just like really got you? Or...
Yeah, I mean, on Cecilia, she drooled Braille Bibles onto the brothel bedspread. Great alliteration there. And there's some other great lines in that song. Time eats at the flesh and spits out the shadow. I assume what they were going for, sort of a metaphor for aging or that kind of thing. At least that's how I'm taking it. And then there's just the screaming of like a useless wishbone, like a useless wishbone. I mean, you could kind of go on and on.
Let's get into the story behind this album. So Ross Robinson, who I mentioned before, considered to be the godfather of nu metal. He had this buddy named Casey Chaos, who was in a band called Amen, and they were kind of also like a nu metal kind of hardcore band. And Casey Chaos used to leave bags of CDs at Ross Robinson's house to check out because, you know, he's always looking for new bands to produce. And the Blood Brothers, This Adultery Is Ripe, which is the one before this album, it was one of those CDs. And Ross took a liking to them, offered them $25,000 in recording budget to come and record with him. And then he ended up putting a sort of a post-hardcore trilogy of albums at the drive-in, who have a lot of similarities with Blood Brothers. And then also this band called Glassjaw. They were really kind of blown away by being even asked. Johnny Whitney said in Stereo Gum, he said, "At the time, it wasn't our preferred vibe or kind of music. In hindsight, I mean, I fucking love Slipknot and a lot of the stuff he did now. But I think I was a little too stuck up at the time to really appreciate what he was doing."
It is pretty kind of wild to think that he did this and Limp Bizkit.
You can hear that chunky, I wouldn't say it sounds like nu metal, but you can hear that chunky guitars, low end, which I think really added to their sound. I think their other stuff kind of suffered from being a bit too thin, almost flat in some ways, but there's a real beefiness to this album.
Yeah, their earlier stuff is definitely, it would have to be, you know, a little more underproduced, but, you know, what I like about Robinson's production on this versus the production on Crimes is, you know, Burn Piano Island Burn still maintains the energy and, like, the personality of, you know, March on Electric Children. It just, you know, polishes it around the edges a little bit.
They end up using John Goodmanson for the next two albums. Also, Guy Picciotto from Fugazi was involved with Young Machetes as well. The band actually said they regretted not going back to Robinson. Whitney had said in Stereo Gum as well, "In a perfect world, if I could go back, I would have Ross do both of our other records. I think turning our back on Ross is probably the thing I regret the most. Considering what an incredibly talented fucking dude he is, and the fact he changed all of our lives irreversibly, the fact that we kind of turned our back on him feels really shitty in hindsight. I wish we had not done that."
Yeah, there are good songs on those other albums, but, you know, especially by the time Young Machetes came along, it felt like they lost a lot of the personality that you made those earlier albums fun. And, I mean, you can attribute it a bit to them kind of aging and maturing as a group too, but, like, you know, Young Machetes wasn't that long after Burn Piano Island Burn. Really, what was it, like 3 years? So, you know, it's not like it's 10 years on and they're just, like, you know, tired of playing this style, although I suppose a bit of that was going on because I think Bliley has talked about how at a certain point, you know, just being angry and screaming and trying to sound angry became boring. And it was more interesting to, you know, think about what you're frustrated about.
Yeah.
So whether or not that influenced their style on Crimes and Young Machetes, maybe.
I read a little piece in Exclaim with Jordan being interviewed, and he almost admitted to the fact that the songs that they wrote for this album were completely impossible to play live. Like, there's no way that you could really pull them off in any kind of a keeping true to those songs. You kind of had to just go almost like free form. And if you look at some of the live footage of them playing on even like TV shows and stuff, it's just a total complete mess. They kind of ran with that in their live shows. They opened up for a couple of bigger bands. And he said that you can see it right in front of your face. You can hear the crowd booing and you can see a kid giving you the finger. The adverse reactions were immediate.
Perhaps they were as alienating as the locusts.
I would have loved to have seen them play live. I never did because I love that kind of like unhinged, off the rail stuff. But, you know, it's interesting that he would say, oh, well, you know, the songs we wrote were so chaotic and were captured by Robinson in his studio. But how do we replicate these when we play?
Right, like they were almost improvising.
Setting themselves up for having to really fly by the seat of their pants, I guess, their tight pants. There's a lot of really great reviews for this album. I mean, it was kind of universally heralded as being one of the forebearers of this emo hardcore, spazzy hardcore scene that got really popular and kind of infiltrated the mainstream in a few ways, as far as some other mainstream bands being way more screamy and stuff. Thinking like, you know, bands like The Used and even At the Drive-In, they got quite big. The reviews were always like backhanded compliments. Like this one from Sputnik Music says, remember that time your toilet was overflowing? Ramp up that nauseating sense of urgency by 20,000 and you have the Blood Brothers' sprawling spastic masterpiece into perspective. And this Drowned in Sound review is pretty funny. The last line is, you will not enjoy this record if you want the demons in your head to go away.
I was surprised by how much Billboard liked it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. They call it the best thing that could happen to rock and roll right now and a landmark album.
Wow. That's
yeah, iconoclastic and non-paradigmatic.
See like a Franz Ferdinand fan picking this up and being like, oh, it's the new, like, this is the best new rock record. And
yeah, right.
Scream and throw the CD in the front yard.
I mean, a sign of how, like, even if the compliments were backhanded, I guess how popular it was with critics at the time, I think, is in the comments from Jordan about what Rolling Stone thought of them. Because, you know, I think there's an interview where he says, you know, Rolling Stone despises us. And you go back and read the review for Burn Piano Island Burn, and, you know, it's like a 3 out of 5 review, which is far from
despising.
Yeah, far from trashing them completely. And that, you know, they actually call the album, you know, meticulously rendered.
Yeah, and the band did get back together once in 2014 for some festival stuff. And then actually just a couple of years ago, there was a festival that a band dropped off of and they actually jumped on. And that was the first show they played for quite a while. You know, they could play again. They could potentially make a new record again. But to replicate or do this kind of record again, I think is off the table. You ready for some YouTube comments?
My favorite part.
All right, so this one's from username ISQ6672, and it was 8 years ago. And they say, my neighbors love this album. I play it for them all the time. This one is from Not26Please, 4 years ago. This sounds like French fries being made. Not a bad comparison, actually. Yeah, this one's probably even a better comparison. So it's by Carlo Morelli, 785. 8 years ago, this is Mars Volta on speedballs in a gay punk bar. Why did this not make more of an impact? Too silly? System of a Down was just as silly, but everyone gives them credit.
So, I mean, I think they did make an impact. That's the thing.
Yeah. I don't think they could have made as much of an impact as some of these other bands that are mentioned.
Yeah, and I'm not sure they were as pop-oriented. Like, I don't know what you saw in the interviews you read, but, you know, I was thinking about the last couple shows we did where we covered White Lung and McCluskey, and in both cases, Falkus and Mishway talked about, you know, wanting to be pop songwriters or wanting to, you know, write pop songs or songs with pop sensibilities, and never saw that in any of the interviews.
Yet there's some really beautiful stuff. There's some crooning ballads. I mean, think of a band like Wolf Parade, you know, or Frog Eyes. Those are bands kind of in the same wheelhouse on the longer, kind of drawn out, more melodic Blood Brothers songs. But then, yeah, they also have kind of that locust noise side as well. if they kind of like quote unquote sold out and done a whole album of the kind of slower ballady stuff, they might have done something. But then of course, you know, that was not, it seemed not really what they wanted to do at all, which is cool.
Or if they, I don't know, played shorter songs, like a lot of these songs clock in at sort of the 4 or 5 minute mark, mm-hmm. which for this type of music, maybe longer than, you know, the average fan is used to, unless you're like into, I guess, more like mathy stuff.
Yeah.
Which this is kind of adjacent to, but doesn't fully fall into that category enough to, you know, pick it up and be like, okay, yeah, I'm gearing up for some 5-6 minute tunes.
Yeah. And then there's people like This Is the End 777, who wrote 4 years ago and it's been edited. Crap album. First heard it when I was on opiates from a car wreck in 2003, and that couldn't even make the sound decent. I love the unapproachable. It's very testy too, right? Like there's songs on here that you're like, okay, get it over with. Okay, this is a high-pitched, croony vocal. Come on. Like, and then it hits you again, and they go back and forth with the two vocalists, and there's all this spazzy guitar work going, and it's like they're really trying to test the listener out here and to see if maybe the listener is going to stick around.
Yeah, right. Can you hang with us?
Totally. All right. Any final thoughts on the album?
Yeah, it was kind of fun going back and listening to this, remembering it as, you know, such a touchstone at the time. Do I feel like it's an all-time album? Do I enjoy it as much as I did at the time? I don't think so, but some of the stuff here does have staying power.
It's very catchy. It's hard not to keep listening to it. Even if you don't really want to hear it again, you kind of have to listen to it again. It's an earworm that becomes like, you're almost like, this is so obnoxious. Am I just listening to this because I'm punishing myself? Or
what scarecrows think would turn your eyeballs pink has been running through my mind all day.
But I love it. But I love it. I love music like this. What a great album and what a great band. Definitely kind of band you can talk about and say, hey, like, check out this band. They were so different and they were so cool. And no one ever really captured what they captured, whether they were inspired by other bands like that or not, or whether, you know, other bands went on to be inspired by them. And this was the pocket, the perfect little place where they landed. And there wasn't a lot of really good things going on in the early 2000s. There was a lot of shite. So I love this album. Really glad that it's around.
Definitely anybody interested in scene history should go about rediscovering it.
All right. So don't forget to listen to the Screen Therapy podcast, which is the podcast that I normally do about punk rock and mental health. And there's about 130 episodes now, so lots to dig through. And we have other episodes of this Flex Your Head special podcast as well, including some with Donald. Yeah, you can get all that at screentherapyhq.com. Thanks so much for talking to me about this album, Donald. It's great to have you again. And I'm glad that we picked this one. It kind of came out of left field, but it was a good pick.
Yeah, thanks, Jason. This was a lot of fun. And maybe the listener count will be higher than McCluskey. I don't know.
Marco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, Le Chablis.
That was some party thanks to my buddy's beer and joint. Here's the keys, joint.
Yo, I'm not driving. I'm way too stoned. How are you feeling, beer?
Oh, since we had that talk, I'm not driving tonight at all.
What about you, Dave?
You only had a couple of drinks.
And only a couple of puffs.
I don't drink and drive. No way I'm getting behind the wheel when I smoked weed, too.
How are we getting home, then?
Come on, Dave. Take one for the team.
Don't let weed and alcohol influence your decision to drive.
Yeah, I need a ride.
A message from Mad Canada.